gave me a bolt cutter. We love to break it. Claim all the space. They forgot they had taken. Welcome back to the Ownership Economy. In this episode, we welcome Dr. Corey Rosen, a champion of employee ownership. Dr. Rosen dives into the shortcomings of the current ownership model, marked by opaque practices and short-term horizons. The conversation shifts to employee stock ownership plans, outlining their benefits, limitations, and reasons for their non-dominant representation in the economy. Please like and subscribe.
Corey, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Martin. It's really a pleasure.
Awesome. So you are, we're super excited to have you on the podcast because you really are one of the architects around shaping employee ownership in the United States and really a force kind of worldwide as well. I think, you know, where we like to start out these interviews is around a bit of your background, your origin story, so to speak, and you have a really interesting one. And so it'd be great to tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I started off as an academic. I did that for a couple of years. I was teaching political science and decided it was something I'd rather do than observe. And so I got a fellowship to work on Capitol Hill. I worked on a Senate staff for the next 5 years. And a few years into that, I read something about this idea of employee ownership, which I'd never heard of before, was in the Congressional Record, and it was testimony by a well-known sociologist who taught at the school where I'd done graduate work. So I read that, and I thought, well, this is what a great idea, what a really interesting idea, and I need to learn more about this. So I did, and it was a very nascent idea at the time. And I was able to get involved in some of the legislation that was being created around that time in the late 1970s. And fortunately, I was able to draft a few bills that did become law on employee ownership, and realized at the time that this was an idea that Republicans and Democrats both liked, which was unusual then, and of course is extraordinary now, but that really could make a difference. When you think about it, changing the ownership of companies so that the employees own them and not, you know, private equity or public capital markets or just a few people is a pretty radical change. And yet this was something that was politically appealing to both sides. So something that could make a big difference, both in terms of the substance of the change, but also was politically practical. And that's an intersection today that's pretty rare. So I was intrigued by this, but I thought, you know, here's this great idea that very few people know about. Businesses don't know that there are a lot of tax advantages to doing this. Employees don't know it's a different way to think about ownership. Politicians knew a little bit about it, but not much. Academics, journalists knew almost nothing about it. We didn't know if it worked or not. There wasn't really any serious research on it at the time. We didn't know what would make it work if it did work. So I thought, well, what if I just start an organization that would devote itself to getting the word out about this, but also doing really high quality research on how employee ownership was working. So I started the National Center for Employee Ownership in a 10 by 10 room in my basement. No money, no grants. We never were grant funded and just hoped for the best. And somehow we created a model that worked. Today, we are a thriving organization. We have 19 employees. And as a business, we're doing quite well. So we're a nonprofit, but we're a little bit unusual in that we don't seek foundation or grant money. We fund ourselves through the work we do. Amazing. So that's how I got started. That was in 1981, and I'm still at it.
Cool. Amazing story. And for people who don't know, the National Center for Employee Ownership is kind of a force of nature around employee ownership in the U.S., really creating kind of both from a policy perspective and also from a research perspective, is kind of the standard on employee ownership. So what I want to do in this interview is go into a bit of depth on this book that you came out with about 9 months ago with John Case, Ownership, Reinventing Companies, Capitalism, and Who Owns What. And where you start out in that book is talking about the current ownership model in society and kind of the landscape. You know, there's the landscape of the United States, but it's also the landscape in most countries around the world, or certainly most rich countries around the world. But the U.S. is kind of maybe the epitome of kind of this bifurcation of the economy. Can you walk us through this landscape and how you see the world today?
Sure. So when you think about capital ownership in the U.S. and, as you say, in most of the industrial world, it falls into three pots. One is public company ownership. And that's maybe 30-40% of the ownership in the economy of capital owning companies. And public company ownership certainly has a lot of advantages for companies and investors, and certainly not something we say we should get rid of public company ownership, but it also has its limitations. We've seen increasingly over the last decades that public companies are really pressed to focus on quarter to quarter or even day to day earnings by their investors. And really, when you think about being an investor in a public company, it's more akin to going to the racetrack and betting on a horse than it is to owning the horse or owning the company. The investors don't typically have a long-term horizon in the company or really any influence in the company. And in fact, the majority of trades in public companies are done algorithmically. So literally, the ownership is for fractions of a second. So the notion of ownership, of people owning public companies, is really distorted. People are making bets on public companies. And the people who are leading those companies need to please their betters by having good short-term returns. That obviously distorts the incentives for investing in the long-term, investing in employees. So that's broken, we think. And aside from that, the ownership in these companies, when you look outside of, say, pension funds, is held primarily by a very small group of people. Second kind of ownership is even more distorted, which is private equity, which is maybe 15% of the ownership right now. And private equity purchases companies on behalf of a few wealthy investors and institutions with a somewhat longer term goal of buying the company and flipping it in 3 to 7 years. They charge all kinds of fees, get all kinds of tax benefits. They typically load these target companies with a lot of debt. Private equity firms are more likely to go out of business. Private equity owned firms are more likely to go out of business. They are more likely to lay people off post acquisition than other companies. But the benefit of this ends up going to this small group of extremely wealthy investors. And then finally, there's what we think of as family-owned businesses, but really all the businesses that are closely held by one or a few individuals. And they do have typically longer-term time horizons. But the issue is eventually those businesses need to be sold. And are they sold to one of those public companies or a private equity or someone else? Well, so that landscape has created this very short-term focus, number one, and it's also created a very concentrated ownership in the hands of a very small number of people. That's really a problem. Because we often talk about income inequality and not making enough money. And sure, that's a big problem. But wealth insecurity is just as much of a problem. Half the population can't put its hands in the U.S. on $1,000 in an emergency. 50% of the private sector workforce is in no retirement plan at all. these are disastrous numbers, and they're much worse for people of color and single women. So how do we address this issue that if so much of the potential future growth of the economy is coming not from wages, which have been stagnant since the 1970s, but from the ownership of capital, which have grown at an inflation-adjusted rate of 8% per year since the 1970s. How do we make people participate in that economy, in the ownership economy? What are the solutions to that? And of course, you're working on, I think, a very innovative idea around that. Employee ownership says, well, let's find a way for them to be owners at work. And it fortunately turns out there are very practical ways to do that.
Awesome. So I want to go into employee ownership in a bit of detail, but I think just some of the numbers in your book that kind of blew my mind a little bit. So we think of research and development as a cornerstone of driving the economy, of driving wealth. The U.S. has been particularly good at this in the past, both through private investment, also in government investment. One of the stats that came out in your book was just the magnitude of share buybacks in the United States over the past decade, with all the liquidity that was generated after the great financial crisis. And one of those specific quotes that you had in the book was around Boeing over this 4-year period, where share buybacks represented $43 billion versus the $16 billion that they actually invested in CapEx, which blew my mind. I mean, I read that and I was like, I went and looked it up because I didn't believe it. But it just gives a sense of, you know, the concentration of wealth that's happening. And then to the extent that there are a group of people that have claims on the asset of these companies that are generating cash flows, they're actually manipulating the cash flows of those companies to pull out more capital that could be going towards growth or could be going towards higher wages. And a lot of the innovation in the US economy increasingly is financial innovation rather than going towards things that actually drive the economy. So I want to get into employee ownership, but before we get into that, you did make a couple of comments in the book about solutions to the problems of short-termism and kind of this environment that's come about that we're outside of the scope of employee ownership. So I think it's worthwhile to touch on those a little bit before really diving into the power of employee ownership. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Well, when you think about the tax structure in the United States and of course the ownership structure, there are tremendous incentives for instance, CEOs of public companies to focus on the short term. For instance, when during the Trump administration, corporate taxes were reduced, the way that they were sold, the way they've always been sold, is, well, companies will have more money and they'll invest it in capital growth. And, you know, it's the definition of insanity. We keep doing the same thing and getting the same result and expecting something different. They take all that extra money and they do what Boeing did, and they buy back shares because that makes their stock market price go up a lot faster in the short term than developing, an ecologically stable, more sustainable airplane. That might not happen for years and it's risky. So the incentive structure for public companies certainly aligns with that. And for private equity, they can get carried interest, for instance, for flipping companies and buying another company and doing the same thing again. So we've actually created an infrastructure that encourages short-term thinking. The typical tenure of a CEO in a public company now is less than 5 years. And those executives at the top are paid primarily in stock. I mean, they're paid enough in stock to buy small countries sometimes, literally. And so if you have stock options, for instance, a lot of your compensation is in the form of options or some other equity grant that will be realized only if the value goes up. you have a built-in incentive to focus on the short-term growth of stock value. So again, the incentives line up all in the wrong direction on this.
And then there's been kind of some calls for, you know, a small tax on capital gains, or on share buybacks.
Right.
You know, it's been hard to put that in place. And you have some other comments, but let's dive into employee ownership in the United States. You've dedicated your entire career really to advancing employee ownership with a lot of success. Can you give us a brief overview of just what the market for employee ownership in the United States is? Like, what does it look like today?
Sure. So there are different ways that employees can become owners in the U.S. Some of them are true in most countries, but some are only true in the U.S. or to some extent the U.K. So there are three primary ways that employees become owners in companies in the U.S. The most powerful is something called an employee stock ownership plan. That's not a generic term. It's a specific statute under the Employee Retirement Income Security Act and was created in 1974. The concept of an ESOP is really pretty straightforward. Let's say a private equity firm, for instance, wants to go buy a company. They want to buy a hardware manufacturing company in the Midwest, and we'll call it ABC Hardware. And it's got 200 employees, and it looks like this is a pretty profitable company. Let's borrow money, buy ABC Hardware, and we will repay the loan that we just took out of the future profits of the company. I mean, why would we even buy it if we didn't think that it could do that, if it could generate enough profits to repay the acquisition debt? And the result is that a few people get richer. Well, Louis Kelso was an investment banker and attorney in San Francisco in the 1950s, said, wait a minute. What if the employees borrowed the money, bought the company, and repaid it out of the future profits of the company? Well, of course, they couldn't do that because nobody would loan them the money, number one, and it would be too risky, number two. So he said, but there's a solution. What if the company sets up a trust that's enabled to borrow the money and the company funds it, not the employees, it's company money. The company funds that trust to purchase the shares by repaying the acquisition loan out of future profits, and will sweeten the deal by making those future profits tax deductible, whereas normally they're not if you're repaying a loan. The interest is deductible, but not the principal. That's a pretty big deal. If you're buying a $5 million company, you might have to have over $7 million in pre-tax profits to repay that loan. But with an ESOP, Kelso said, you'll only have to have $5 million because of the deduction. There were a number of steps needed for that to become legal, and that was created in 1974. And it became part of retirement law in the U.S., largely by accident, because that happened to be the legislative train that was leaving the station. So it became part of that law. Basically, what it says is a company can set up a trust and it can either have the trust borrow money to purchase shares from an existing owner or new shares. It can just contribute cash to the trust to buy shares over time, or it can just print shares and put those shares into the trust. The shares in the trust are then allocated to accounts for employees. So basically, everybody who's worked there for a year becomes a participant in the plan. They get allocated shares over time based on an equitable formula. When they eventually leave the company, the shares are repurchased from them by the company. So that was the tax landscape in 74. And over time, Congress kept adding more goodies. So the bill that I wrote said that if you sell to an ESOP and you're a closely held company, you can take the gains that you've made from the sale, you can reinvest them in stocks and bonds of US companies and defer any taxes. In the UK, they have a similar approach to us, but there you can not pay any tax at all if you sell to an employee ownership trust. So that was good. And then in 1997, Congress said, well, we've got one more really important goodie to add. And that is, if you are an S corporation, the way you're taxed is that the profits are attributed to owners, and the owners pay a tax pro rata on their share of the profits. But if one of the owners is an ESOP, it doesn't have to pay any tax on its share of the profits. So if you're 100% owned by an ESOP, you don't pay any taxes at all. So tax nirvana. You don't have to pay any federal or state income tax. Your seller, if you set it up properly, can get a tax deferral on the gain. And as you're getting to that 100% transaction level, you can take deductions for what you put into the plan to buy the shares. The employees end up not paying a nickel for those shares. So that's the primary mechanism, and it's used not entirely, but largely by owners of closely held companies who are thinking of retiring or just want to get some of their ownership off the table. Or maybe there's multiple owners and one wants to sell and one doesn't. And for these owners, this is a really intriguing opportunity. Here's a way that you can get a fair price for your company, because that's basically how the deal is structured. You have a fair market value set by an appraiser. So you can get a fair price for your company. You can get tremendous tax benefits. Your company can get tremendous tax benefits. Your employees don't pay anything. The legacy that you've worked all your life to build gets preserved rather than this company being sold to somebody else who might not have the same values and the same approach to your community. And if you want to stay on in any capacity you like, you can do that. So that's a pretty compelling proposition. So that's ESOPs. And there's about 6,500 ESOPs. There's 14 million participants. There are quite a few ESOPs in public companies which use them primarily just as an additional employee benefit, not obviously to buy the whole company. There are quite a few major US companies that are 100% employee owned. There are 100 companies with more than 1,300 employees who are 100% or more owned by an ESOP, for instance. The biggest majority employee-owned company, Publix Supermarkets, has 225,000 employees. So while they're used a lot in companies, say, from 20 to 100 employees, they're also used in some of our major businesses, like 7 of the largest 15 engineering companies are 100% owned by ESOPs. Then there's stock options, restricted stock, and the like. So these are equity grants that are made to employees. And overwhelmingly, these are made just to key employees. But in technology startup companies and some other companies, it's quite common to give out some kind of equity grant to everyone, at least for the first number of years of their existence. And there are some public companies, like Starbucks, for instance, that give stock options to everyone as just part of their culture. And then finally, there's employee stock purchase plans, which are just in public companies, which provide employees with significant discounts to purchase shares in their company. These are financially very appealing, but people typically are living paycheck to paycheck and feel like they can't put the money aside, even though doing so would be really beneficial. So these employee stock purchase plans typically only get 20, 30% of the workforce to participate. Altogether, if you add all those up, there's a 25 million or so employee owners in the US.
So that was an amazing overview. One thing, when you really laid out kind of all of the benefits of employee ownership and the tax advantages of employee ownership, one would think that this would be the dominant form of ownership in the United States. Not even including kind of the other mechanisms for ownership through 401ks and stock options and employee stock purchase plans. What has prevented employee ownership from becoming the dominant form of ownership in the US?
Well, I would say, you know, the public companies and private equity companies aren't going to use ESOPs. At least occasionally a private equity company does. And there is a movement among some private equity firms when they buy a company to give the employees, say, 5% of the equity. So an improvement, but not where we'd like to be. The real market for ESOPs is in closely held companies with an owner who's thinking about moving on or just wants to get some liquidity. And you're right, given the advantages of ESOPs, why wouldn't more do it? Well, some companies are just way too small to do it. So it costs a lot of money to set up these plans. There's a lot of regulatory hoops to jump through. It's not more expensive or complicated than selling to another buyer, but it is $150,000, $200,000 and up. So if you're a company with under 20 employees, for instance, those costs may not be justified by the tax benefits that you get from it. So that's one barrier for the really smaller companies. For companies that are big enough, 15, 20 employees or more, and profitable enough to do this, the biggest problem is that the owner goes to his or her accountant or a broker and says, you know, I'm thinking of moving on, what can I do? Well, most of the advisors don't know what an ESOP is, or if they've heard of it, they have misinformation about it. And even if they have good information, their incentives typically are not to advise their client to do it for two reasons. One is they may think, well, I'm not an expert on this and it's complicated. There's a lot of stuff I need to know. And so they might not use me to help guide them through this process. They'll hire somebody else. Second, if I don't understand something, there's kind of a natural human tendency to say, if I don't understand it, it's probably not a good idea. And finally, if you're a broker that's helping find a buyer, you get a success fee for finding a buyer, typically 2 to 5% of the sale of a company. So, you know, when people think about fees of selling a company and the cost of an ESOP, keep in mind that if you have, say, a $10 million business, you might spend $300,000 just in brokerage fees to sell your business, let alone lawyers and accountants and all of that. Well, if the business owner comes to you and say, hey, I went to the National Center for Employee Ownership website and I got this book and I learned about ESOPs and this is what I want to do. And the broker says, okay, I can find you a buyer. It's the ESOP. And I will charge you 3% of the transaction price for finding you the buyer that you already found. So if I'm a broker, and I've had brokers tell me this, if I can't charge a success fee, I'm not going to tell them about ESOPs. So misinformation and the wrong incentive structure is a huge barrier. And the big policy push, I think, right now needs to be primarily on getting the word out. And that comes through state programs to fund efforts to do this kind of outreach. And that's just beginning to happen.
That was a great overview. There's one other thing that I didn't know about when I read the book, which is that the price and the acquisition is determined at this arm's length at fair market value. And so if I'm a private equity firm or I'm a corporation that's divesting of an asset or divesting of a division or of a company, if I sell to an ESOP, I can't take into account kind of synergy with whatever new entity is being put together. And so that was one other area where I thought, okay, that starts to make sense why you start to have these challenges around growing the base of companies or growing the percentage of kind of GDP that's represented by employee owners.
So the owners of privately held companies, the M&A people tell us, net of the tax benefits, maybe 15% of the time could get a higher price selling to another buyer. So for some, if that's what you're focused on, and most of the sellers who sell to ESOP, it's not their primary focus. But if your primary focus is getting the highest price and you have a business that can create those kind of synergies, you may be better off selling to someone else. And if you're a public company selling off a division, you don't get the tax benefit of the deferral of taxation that the owner of a private company does. So for a public company to sell off a division, they're under a fiduciary obligation to get the highest price.
Interesting. All comes down to incentives. So you've spent most of your career really figuring out how to advance this cause. And you're still going after, is it 40, 50 years?
45 years, yeah.
45 years. And you have a lot of good ideas in the book for how to increase ownership in the United States and around the world. And I found that the second half of the book, really, there were a bunch of ideas that I, you know, in academic papers and reading and doing the podcast, I still hadn't come across. And so I'm wondering if you could walk through some of these policy ideas that you're working on now to increase ownership in the US.
Sure. So starting with ESOPs, which is the biggest opportunity, I think, one of the things that's encouraging, and it's very nascent, is states creating programs to do outreach to help business owners understand that this really is an option, and helping to create an infrastructure of resources to give them information that they can use. Colorado, Massachusetts, and Washington now all have programs at the state level like this. We think next year, Pennsylvania and Tennessee might well join them. Looks like legislation is quite promising in those states. And we're hoping that other states will follow suit. Last year, Congress passed what's called the WORK Act, which was based on a bill I wrote 37 years ago for a senator from Tennessee. And I kept sort of nudging people and talking about it. And then other people started talking about it. And what the WORK Act says is that the federal government, Department of Labor, will provide funds to states to set up these outreach programs. And it provides funding over a 5-year period. Now, the law passed, fortunately, but this year Congress has to decide whether to actually fund it. And because of all the budget dysfunction in Congress right now, we don't know whether it'll get the funding that was set out for it or not. So I hope so, but that's to be determined. And the funding, there won't be a decision specifically about that. If the decision is made, well, the Department of Labor can't have any funding increase and no new programs, period, as a result, then we're sort of screwed on that. Have to hope for a better Congress in the future. But that's really encouraging if it does actually get funded. The states have also, Colorado and Washington, created a tax credit for some of the initial costs of setting up an ESOP or worker co-op or other forms of employee ownership. And that can really make it easier for companies to do this who are kind of on the fence. So these are great programs. So that's the that I think is the main way we can get more information out there, is getting at the local level. You know, when you think about it, states spend over $100 billion with a B, billion dollars in tax incentives every year to get companies to move from one place to another or to stay where they are. You know, all the bond measures and tax reductions and the circus that, you know, surrounded where Amazon headquarters would be, helping wealthy companies, giving them a whole bunch more money, or sports teams to build an arena. And it generates no net new jobs at all by definition, right? Because you're just moving from one place to another. Whereas spending hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in an employee ownership outreach program could generate lots of new jobs, because employee ownership companies grow faster than comparable non-employee ownership companies. So there's a compelling policy argument to be made around this. And like every other thing on employee ownership, these bills pass unanimously. California passed a similar bill last year, and we're not sure if it's going to get funded this year because of the budget crisis here. So we'll see. Second thing is, and this gets a little sort of weedy, but if I'm selling to an ESOP and I want to sell 100% of the company, the bank's going to loan me some of that money, but not all of that money. No bank's going to loan 100% of the value of a company. They can't collateralize it. So maybe the bank will loan me 30 or 40%, and the rest I'm going to need to finance by taking a note to be paid off over time. Well, a lot of owners are just fine with that. They, you know, they'll get 8-9% interest rate over the next 7 years, and that's fine. But other owners say, I don't want to take the risk, or I need the money up front. And so they're going to want to sell to somebody who can write them a check. So how do you fill that financing gap? And there's a bill in Congress now. It's a bipartisan bill. Senator Rubio and Senator Van Hollen, Democrat and Republican, are lead sponsors in the Senate, for instance. And what it does is it creates a kind of investment corporation that's dedicated to employee ownership transactions. And the federal government would help back these investment corporations. They exist for a lot of other purposes now. They're already similar programs from the federal government for other kinds of investment. And they would enable more of the loan to come from second parties rather than from the seller. So that would make more of the transaction financeable upfront. It's called the Employee Equity Investment Act. And like anything in, you know, in any legislation, even though it has broad support, its prospects are uncertain because passing any legislation is hard. But if it did pass, it would be, I think, a real game changer. It might also induce some public companies to divest companies to ESOPs, because one of the barriers to them is also that the public company doesn't want to take back debt for selling off one of its divisions. So the less debt it has to take on, the more likely these sorts of things are to happen. So those are the things we think that would move ESOPs along. On the public company front, where companies are giving out equity awards to their executives, and you can do the math on this. And if you looked at, say, the top 100 companies, if they divided the equity that they give out to the top 5 people amongst all of their employees, it would end up being a few thousand dollars per year per employee. It's an astonishing number. It's what's going to 5 people, but went to 40,000 people, would be $3,000-$5,000 per year per employee.
Which doesn't seem like a lot, but if you look at kind of the distribution of wealth in the United States, once you get below the 50% threshold, like no one has any wealth, or you have negative wealth when you're in the bottom quintile. So
that's right. And if you're doing this over a 20, 30 year career and you've got another $100,000-$150,000 that you wouldn't have had otherwise, that can be life-changing for people. So right now, companies do this. The law was changed so that they don't get a tax deduction for giving all this equity to employees, to the top five people. But you could create a tax penalty to say if you're going to give it to the top five people and you don't give some, say, 50% of what you give to them to divide up amongst everybody else, you have to pay an excise tax. Well, maybe that would induce some companies, although I'm a little bit skeptical even of our own proposal, because there's such a cultural norm in these companies that the only people who really matter are the top drivers of the company. But that's something that, might be considered. For things like employee stock purchase plans, there are some innovative ideas on how you could reduce the risk for these plans for employees by, there could be loan programs to put more money into these plans that were non-recourse. So for instance, in Korea, there's a system where you can borrow money to buy stock in your publicly traded company at a discount, and you repay the loan by giving back to the lender some of the shares that you purchased. So you can't lose any money. Say you buy 10 shares and you say, well, it's all borrowed money, and I will repay the loan by giving you 8 shares back and keeping 2. So it's a very clever idea, I think. There's some big companies in Europe who've done something similar on their own. So that's another way that you might induce higher participation in stock purchase plans. So those are some of the things with employee ownership per se. There's sort of employee ownership adjacent things like platform cooperatives, which I think is a really intriguing idea. If you think about Uber or Lyft, it's just a platform and it's owned by a small number of people relatively. I mean, there's public companies, but when they're started, they're owned by a small number of people. When they're public, it's still highly concentrated in terms of wealthier people being the biggest owners. Whereas the people who are generating the income for Uber or Lyft are not paid much at all. Well, what if those drivers owned the platform instead? And in New York and Denver, they're doing just that. They've created apps. Software has been contributed by nonprofits. And so once the software is created, the drivers own the app, and the app does what it does for Uber and Lyft. Except that now all the benefits go to the drivers instead of being concentrated in the hands of a smaller number of people. That same idea can be applied to all sorts of gig work. And there are some other examples of it now as well, like Stocksy, which is for photographers to sell their photography online for all sorts of commercial purposes. If you buy something from Stocksy, the platform is owned by the artists themselves.
Makes a lot of sense. I'm doing this case study on Stocksy right now, and we had Alyssa Orlando on the podcast 6 months ago, and she was one of the kind of the first people in at Drivers Cooperative. And we just talked about the challenges of multi-stakeholder cooperatives and getting them off the ground. And then also one of the challenges is around, there's a lot of the venture capital that goes into firms early on at Uber or Lyft goes towards faking supply. So essentially subsidizing supply platform, such that like if you're waiting on the corner for an Uber or Lyft, you're only going to wait for a few minutes, right? So they have to essentially pay these drivers to be on the roads when they're going into a new city. And that's where a lot of the VC money went, was to ensure that your time to pick up was very, very small. And so one of the challenges with driver cooperatives was not only, you know, how do you attract talent that will come and work for the cooperative at a lower price point when you need really good engineering talent? They seem to overcome some of that, but then how do you subsidize the supply to ensure that you have enough liquidity on the marketplace? And the way that they overcame that was through doing government contracts, but they really had to focus on very specific niches to be able to overcome that without access to growth capital. So I think the platform co-op space, it's interesting, but the two challenges around how do you get funding into those ventures where they can compete. Stocksy was started by someone who had already had an exit before, and so he lent debt to the company, and then the company paid it back over a couple of years, is still a challenge, right, in terms of the initial financing. And then how do you attract talent consistently to compete over time? But I'm, you know, of course, I'm super interested in that space. So I want to, in closing up, I want to get a little bit personal here, and ask you a couple of questions just about kind of, you know, the work you've done over 45 years. In today's world, when people are thinking about their career, we often think about, you know, different careers or switching careers. People often burn out of causes because it's hard to stay focused on one mission. And it's very rare that you hear of leaders that have worked on a particular issue for most of their lives. And so I guess my question is kind of, how did you stay so committed to this when I'm sure it was incredibly painful? Kind of, so I mean, I think about writing bills, I think about, you know, going through the regulatory process in the United States. You know, it's horrible now, but even, you know, at any point, it's probably a very difficult process. What really kind of drove you over these years to really focus on this issue?
Well, what attracted me to begin with was I always wanted to work on some cause. That was the only thing that really seemed to me worth spending your time on in life. And of course, I needed to make enough money to do that, but I needed to find a job that could do that. But there were a lot of causes that weren't going to work. I mean, I really wanted to be involved in environmental issues and climate change, which I read about in the 70s and became convinced this was going to be a terrible thing. But I didn't have the expertise, and lots of other people did. And a friend of mine, when I was working on Capitol Hill, we were working on an issue on reforming water reclamation laws in California to make them more equitable for family farmers. And he said, he gave me some really good advice. He said, if you want a career in creating change that's going to work, find something that really matters, but that nobody else knows much about, and you can be the real expert. And then you can really make a difference in a way that's much harder if you go into some established field with lots of people working on it. Now, that was an interesting idea. And obviously I took his advice because hardly anybody knew about this. And at the same time, when I thought about it, I thought, this is an idea that can really transform people's lives. And I should add, by the way, it has participants in ESOPs. This is part of what keeps me going. Participants in ESOPs have three times the retirement assets of comparable employees in companies that have retirement plans. And as I said, 50% of the workforce isn't in any retirement plan at all. these companies generate more job growth, 2.5% more job growth per year than would have been expected absent an ESOP. They lay people off at 1/3 to 1/5 the rate of other companies. They have much higher retention rates than other companies. Employees in these companies, over time, one of the things that I think we've really accomplished as an organization is helping companies understand what sort of culture you want to create. And so employees in these companies are more often than not now in companies that really value their voice and give them opportunities for input, make work much more rewarding. So I've seen the growth of employee ownership. I've seen its political practicality. I'm frustrated that it's not more, but I go to our conferences, I talk to companies, and I talk to people whose lives were changed. I talk to people who say it's the best thing that ever happened to me, that I can retire comfortably, that somebody listens when I have an idea, that we feel like we have a real sense of community and common purpose at work. And I hear these stories all the time. And every time I hear one of these stories, I think, I am really glad I'm working in this field. The other day, I was reading a press release from one of our members, Jasper Engines in Missouri. They make truck engines, several hundred employees. 30% of their employees, these are factory workers, have seven-figure account balances, and 50% have over 500,000.
Wow.
I mean, these are, they're a very successful company to say the least, but this is wealth that's being captured by the right people. I just saw a press release from a company called Houchins. It started off as a chain of supermarkets, became 100% employee owned. Now that's 28% of their business. They become a diversified holding company with 16,000 employees, still 100% employee owned. And this year, which I think is marking, I think their ESOP started in 88. This year, they are marking $2 billion in distributions to participants.
Wow.
$2 billion that got captured by employees, not by a handful of people.
Incredible.
When I hear these stories, that keeps me going. And the people in this field are wonderful. You know, the people I work with are extraordinary. And I honestly can say that I get up every day being grateful that I can still do this.
Awesome. I guess one last question about kind of building an institution. You know, the NCEO is going to survive you. In the sense that there's continuity. And at some point you decided that you wanted to step back and hire what's effectively a CEO in a nonprofit organization, an executive director. But how did you decide about that transition? A lot of people, you know, fail to make that transition. It's a hard transition to make. It's actually much harder, I think, in a nonprofit than it is in a for-profit in some ways. How did you kind of come to that conclusion and execute on it? And when was the right time to put someone into that operational role?
So I told my board 15 years into being the director that in 15 years, I was still around, that I was not going to be the director anymore and we get a new one. That I thought 30 years was plenty of time, maybe too much time for one person to run the organization, and that change would probably be good. And I stuck with that. So I was 62 at the time. I'm 74 now. And that was 30 years. And I said, I'm going to have a new director. Lauren Rogers, who has been on our staff, became the new director. And I still like doing this. I'm going to stop taking a salary. I get a little bit of I get part of a bonus that we pay each year, but no salary. And I'm going to be a sort of close to full-time volunteer because I love doing this. And that's what I did. And it's been great for me personally. I get to focus on the things that particularly interest me. I get to see the organization thrive. It's grown probably in ways with under Lauren that it wouldn't have grown under me. So I'm really happy to see that. And it feels great. So we were always a very consensual organization. So it was never an issue of, well, I want to be in control. I never wanted to be in control. So that was not hard to give up. I didn't feel like I was giving anything up.
Still, it's really impressive what you've built over the course of the last, well, really just your entire career, but at the NCAO over the last 40 years. So in closing out here, where can people follow you online if they want to follow your work?
Well, the easiest way is go to our website at National Center for Employee Ownership. That's nceo.org. And it's a pretty dense site. There's lots of information there on how to do employee ownership, what employee ownership is. There's extensive research reported under where it says data. You can see the summaries of all of the research and links to the important studies. So that's the easiest way. People should feel free to reach out to me. I'm on LinkedIn, or you can email me at crosen@nceo.org. My email's on the website. And I really do welcome people contacting me. As you can probably tell, I like to talk about this. it is a passion, and I'm just delighted to see the work that you're doing, Martin. I think it's fascinating and important and innovative, and we need more of these adjacent concepts, the different ways of rethinking the economy. So I'm tremendously encouraged to see what you're doing and to see the progress you've made so quickly is really impressive.
Well, thank you. Well, you're the inspiration, right? So thank you so much for your time and joining us. I'm looking forward to having you on again, you know, in the near future.
Great. I'll give you the advice in closing that somebody gave to me after the second year when I didn't think we were ever going to make it as an organization. He was the CEO of an employee-owned company. He said, "Don't worry, the first 20 years are the hardest."
Oh man, I hope it's not 20 years, but okay. All right, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you, Martin.
We hope you enjoyed this week's episode of The Ownership Economy. Don't forget to like and subscribe.